Hello, everyone. Welcome to One More Prime, the Transformers Watch Along. I am Mike Schwartz, a concerned parent. I am joined by my kids, Emmett and Elsa.
Hello.
Hi.
We need to sit down, close the door. Let's have a little talk. Kids, I feel that this episode should be prefaced with, well, I wouldn't call it a warning, per se, but more of a note of caution. Let me pull this up. Someone else wrote this better than I could have ever said, but to let you know, I'm reading it from the heart. Okay. According to the Cybertronian Surgeon General, consumption of Energon impairs your ability to drive a car, turn into a car, operate machinery, operate friends that turn into machinery, and it may cause health problems or the inability to fight back against an opposing force of giant robots. Hang on, there's more! I just want you to be safe. You must be of legal age, 1 million years old, to purchase or consume Energon. Oh, okay. I'm glad we had that talk. You're growing up so fast, and I know your friends may think that drinking Energon is cool, but there's a time and a place. Like this episode. Today's guest is Stephanie Cook.
Yay!
Stephanie is the writer of the graphic novels Paranorthern, illustrated by Mary Costa, and Oh My Gods, co-written by Insha Fitzpatrick and illustrated by Juliana Moon. Oh My Gods 2, The Forgotten Maze, just came out and is available wherever fine graphic novels are sold. Written by David Wise and airing on October 7th, 1985, this is Microbots. All right, we are here with Stephanie Cook. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As we talked about before you coming on the show, Transformers is not a specialty.
Like, I'm very aware of them, and like, I just didn't really have like a lot of like TV growing up. Like, my parents were like, go play outside, go read a book. So like, the Transformers are something that I've seen bits and pieces of. I've obviously seen the movies, but that's kind of like the extent of my knowledge.
What cartoons did you grow up with?
Very like minimal things. Like, so my mom would used to hide our TV in the garage. Again,
oh, wow.
Very much like, play outside, go read a book. But when we did have like TV, I definitely grew up on like X-Men, the animated series. I grew up on Batman, the animated series.
Nice.
And then there's just like a lot of like really strange Canadian shows. I feel like they didn't make it elsewhere that I weirdly grew up on. And I'm definitely forgetting like a ton of things. We have like that Canadian content. Like, there's a certain amount of.
By law, stuff. Right? Like, they have to have so much.
Yeah.
Like on like rock stations, they have to have so much.
Yes, exactly. So there's like. So there's like music that is like ingrained in every single Canadian that like feels like it's like something that should be everywhere. It's like, oh yeah, that song. But then you realize it's a Canadian band and nobody's ever heard of them outside of Canada.
So how big is Our Lady Peace in Canada?
Very big.
Like, okay.
Not so much like now, but like during like the 90s and like early 2000s, like definitely like a big, big thing.
That was the band that they would play on. They were out of Canada, 89X, but they would. Yeah. That was kind of like the Detroit Canadian rock station, and they played mostly alternative stuff. But yeah, then there would always be this other band, which I liked. But yeah, it was like, oh, this is weird. It's before I learned about the Canadian like airtime legalities of that. It's like,
yeah, okay. it's very strange, and like. The Tragically Hip are like a really big thing here. And that's kind of like sort of big, I guess, in comics in a way. Like, Jeff Lemire did a book with the lead singer of that before he passed away of cancer a few years back. And so, I think there's definitely like TV shows, music, etc., movies that are just very Canadian that you feel as a Canadian is everywhere, but it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived close enough to the border, too, that, like, a lot of the stations I got growing up when we did have the TV were, like, American.
When you found it after your mom hit it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, my mom would, like, bring back the TV very occasionally, like, usually when something she wanted to watch was, like, on. And then it was, like, too much work to put the TV away before like the season of whatever it was over.
How big was this TV?
Oh God, it was like so small. Like, you know, they were heavier nothing like what we have today. Yeah. Yeah. It was like maybe like 14 inches. Like my computer is probably bigger than our TV was, mm-hmm. you know, like.
Yeah. I remember when I was really young, we may have been on vacation in Canada, and I remember seeing a Peanuts cartoon dubbed in French. And it blew my mind. It's like, why? Like, Snoopy.
So obviously, like, French is our second language in Canada. But it's like, there aren't a lot of provinces that kind of, like, require it to also speak. But, like, Quebec, like, French is the language. It's not English. Like, English is the second language there. And then, actually, the only true, like, bilingual province is actually New Brunswick. And it's the Eastern Canadian world is like a bit strange sometimes too, because like Acadian and there's like all kinds of like different accents and kind of just like Quebec French isn't technically like France French. Like it's, we're a strange little country.
Yeah, it's strange, but it's not as strange as this crashed ship underground.
That was a good segue though. That was like impressive.
Okay, let's go with it then. So we are going to go into microbots. Just so you know, Stephanie, like a lot of the episodes, especially season two has 49 episodes, up from 16 episodes from season one. So there's a lot of mind control episodes. There's a lot of duplicate, like who's the real Optimus Prime. So kind of getting into the sort of kind of cookie cutter 80s cartoon plot lines.
They were selling toys here. They weren't trying to win any Emmys.
Right. But this one, when I watched it, it almost has a Simpsons structure where kind of like each act is almost a whole different story.
Yeah, it does.
Because it starts out, it's almost like an ancient relic discovery plot
what's
line.
It gonna be
like what's inside the ship, and then it gets into they just drop that, and then it's a super powered Megatron, which they've done before, and then it gets into like a Fantastic Voyage. So like every act kind of Stephanie, you're very lucky. This is a very unique episode.
Ooh, I'm feeling blessed.
We begin with archaeology in South America. The thing that stuck out to me was Joan, the kind of really cool looking archaeologist with really cool blue hair.
I love her hair.
Yeah, she sort of has like a Ellen Ripley look from Aliens. And
I can see that.
She does not stick around, unfortunately.
No one does in this construction
site. No one does.
Archaeology site.
Yeah. So this guy's really proud that he found a jar. And then she finds a gigantic spaceship.
Yeah. She really one-upped him.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, metal? There's no metal. Seemingly a few minutes later, they have uncovered.
Yeah. They didn't have tractors. They're just really good with shovels.
Another cool thing they could have gone with is sort of like a Ancient Aliens kind of crystal skull type of thing.
Yeah, they could have. Like, that's a Decepticon ship. Oh, it ain't.
Yeah, because it's kind of building a mystery of like, well, what's inside? Who's inside? Because season two is where they introduce a lot of new, we say characters, you might say toys.
A lot of the time, out of nowhere.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They don't really spend a lot of time explaining where these new characters come from, but this would have been a good opportunity. But instead, there's something else inside later, which we will get to.
The Decepticons are watching news.
He is literally watching the news. There's a newscaster. So this is your favorite character, Emmett. So this is Perceptor. He's the most guys turn into trucks or cars or jeeps, but he turns into a giant microscope. So he's just trying to be on his own and, do science stuff. But Brawn, the little guy, he's being a real jerk. It kind of sets up like a science versus muscle argument throughout the whole
I didn't get this. Like, again, coming to this, like, from nowhere, I was like, leave this guy alone. Like, he's being really helpful. Like, why is this guy so mean to this guy? Like, this is a real, like, jocks versus nerds kind of thing.
It is, yes.
Like, is he going to give him a wedgie, too? Like, come on. My God.
Yeah, it's established in other episodes that Braun, he's like the little fire plug of the group. He's not quite Wolverine.
But even like Wolverine is like understands that people have different roles, you know, like he would never be like, oh, Beast, like science, who has use for that?
Yeah,
like, you know, and so I don't know this. I get it. It's like, you know, literally Braun, like brains versus brawn. Like, mm-hmm. I get that. But yeah, I'm like fixing things. These things wouldn't work. You all wouldn't work if I didn't do these things. And he's like, yeah, yeah, but you stay real like unscathed in these fights.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like there's literally one of their friends on the table getting operated on. And then yeah, he's having none of it.
That's like a football player and a surgeon arguing while you're having like an open heart surgery.
Yeah, he just comes into the operating room. Optimus is being the father figure, tells everyone to break it up.
Well, you got it. You got to be the leader.
Optimus kind of tells him about the spaceship discovery, and then they drive to South America, and the Decepticons are already there, and they're just wasting the rainforest. They're just blasting it away indiscriminately.
Because they're jerks. That's what they do.
Yeah.
I love that they're also subtle, being like, yeah, we got to stay under the radar. We can't be flying around or else people are going to notice. But like, meanwhile, they're like, pew, 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 like shooting off like lasers. Like,
They kind of take a break where Starscream gets attacked by a giant snake and Ravage, the Jaguar Decepticon, gets attacked by an actual jaguar.
Big cat versus big cat with rockets.
I know, and he fires a missile at him and knocks the cat out of the tree. I just like it how it's a little aside. I think they needed time for the Autobots to show up, that they're just gonna have and then he smacks the cat.
I feel like this entire episode is just like asking questions about what I saw.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
That's cool. Fine.
How the heck does an excavator sniff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're walking along. Yeah, he makes a sniffing noise. This is Scavenger. And so he's sniffing out an energy signature, and they come upon the spaceship and Joan and the other guys. And then they just open fire. They drive away in their Jeep, never to be seen from again. And so the Decepticons, they could have just opened the door, but they blast a big hole in the side of the ship.
If they know what's inside, then why'd they do that?
Right. And they find the heart of Cybertron, which
right there.
Yeah, it's right outside the door. Well, Elsa, this is the heart of Cybertron. This is a very powerful source of energy.
I know that.
It's the heart of Cybertron.
I didn't know that Joan came back.
Yeah.
She never did.
It's kind of this
very briefly
cool green crystal that is enough to power a spaceship, but Megatron has it put inside himself. He kind of like gingerly lays down on the ground and has it implanted in him.
Yeah.
And then Megatron gets superpowered. And you know when bad guys get superpowered that they shoot lightning out of their fingertips. Yeah, they get the force lightning.
Emperor.
Which he's had before, right?
Yeah.
I believe so in another episode.
Well, how else would we know that he's superpowered if not for the lightning?
Oh, right.
I mean, you know, grow a couple sizes, change color, but that would be too expensive. And several Autobots show up that have... There was just like four driving, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that takes us to commercial one. And so, Stephanie, we have a couple of questions to ask you. We'll just talk about your books right now, Paranorthern and Oh My Gods. The thing I like about them is that they're kind of a fun blend of smaller, relatable settings, like a school or a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And then they have...
Add a twist.
A twist of supernatural or fantasy elements. I think it's kind of cool and easier to relate to for maybe younger readers rather than just kind of setting it like straight fantasy. So like what inspired you to kind of go that route rather than just go, you know, like this fully fantastical magical world?
I think, like, I mean, with the Greek mythology, I think a lot of young people already have a pretty decent understanding of that. Like, I think people are really interested in Greek mythology, and it's like one of those things that feels like something, well, at least for me when I was reading it growing up, you know, like it felt like something for like an older audience, and like that was like really cool to me, but it was like still like really monsters and magic and like really cool stuff. And it's easier with that world because like that's kind of already been established, and you can play within a sandbox that's already been, you know, formed to some degree. With Paranorthern, like I like the idea of kind of creating like parallel worlds where, you know, magic exists, and like they're not so dissimilar from like our world that you have to do a lot of like setup. When you're writing like stories for like younger audiences, like the page counts that you kind of get approved tend to be on the lower side. So it's like, how do you tell a fun, engaging story without having to kind of explain the world too much, right? And it's like, you kind of have to find this medium, unless you've already been kind of like signed up for like six books in a movie, that like you need to find that kind of middle ground where what can kind of establish the kind of world you're in, and what kind of things can you immediately establish being different, you know? Like, and I loved the idea of playing with a world that was similar to ours, but magic exists. And playing around with just like humans with magic has been done so many times before. And I love like supernatural stuff. And it's like, what else could I play with and bring into this world to make it kind of more fun and mystical and exciting? You know, like it just kind of feels like if you have the ability to create all of these fantastical places, why would you just want to have it all be about humans? You know, it's like kind of like Star Wars, like the most interesting characters to me are like the aliens, like the other, you know, species and creatures, and robots. We don't really get to see, yeah, like we don't really get to see stories kind of like heavily featuring them, although obviously that's kind of like changing a bit now that we're exploring those in the TV shows and stuff, but they're still largely focused on, you know, the human characters, more or less.
No, you make a good point, because I'm kind of flipping through, and yeah, by page 10 in Paranorthern, you know, there's just like a people waiting in line at the cafe, and you see a pumpkin head person, and a Frankenstein, yeah, and a Dracula, yeah, and even like 10 pages in, it's like, oh, okay, this is not the real, you know, our world, this is something different, and something like that's not the driver of the story. It's like, okay, this is established. This is established world of mystical creatures just hang out and grab a coffee before probably going to work, or, you know, taking their kids to school.
Yeah, I think like it's like, if you think about how we would approach finding out that like magic or gods and goddesses exist, it would seem like, you know, like there was like a few years ago when the government was like, yeah, these are UFOs. And everyone was just like so chill about it. Like it was like, oh, yeah, not, you know, like it was like, is it still like a hoax though? Like people were like, is it, like the government's like, yeah, like these are, we can't explain these. And people are like, but like, is it? And so,
yeah, we're not saying like they're not aliens, but we don't know what they are.
Yeah. And so I don't know, like, I kind of feel like that really got like swept under the rug in like a lot of ways, you know, so it doesn't seem implausible to me to like have a form of magic or like a world of magic within our world, and to like not be able to really like comprehend that that's a thing, you know. It's like the deny, you want to deny it and be like, yeah, yeah, sure, like these theater school kids, they're real like wacky and committed to being method here. And I don't know, like to me, I feel like even though I've always, as like for as long as I could remember, like looked for other worlds, you know, like I wished my wardrobe opened up into like Narnia. I wished, you know, the skeleton keys in my great grandma's house like would turn a door into a magical world. It's just, you want the magic to kind of exist, and yet I kind of feel like there would be a big disconnect should those things actually happen, you know? But I just like really, I like playing around with supernatural things, magical things, and things that I just have loved and been deeply interested in, and seeing, you know, what I can kind of do with those. And to me, it's like a lot of fun to kind of explore what else we can kind of do beyond just kind of using, like, Abby in Paranorthern is obviously human, and most of the characters in Oh My Gods are human too, or, you know, slightly deityized.
Yeah.
Elven.
But I still think, like, there's, like, just something very relatable even about, like, the other characters too. Like, they're still, they all, in, like, Paranorthern, they all have, like, a lot of very down-to-earth kind of qualities, but just while they're dealing with, like, other things. And I don't know, it's just more fun to kind of, like, imagine what they would be.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Oh My Gods, you work with a co-writer, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Insha Fitzpatrick. She's wonderful.
So how does that process work with a co-writer? Like, how does that carry through the production of the book?
Yeah, I've been really blessed to have, like, really wonderful collaborators since I've been working on comics. I'm working on another thing with a collaborator right now, and it's just, like, the best experience. But with Oh My Gods, like, Insha and I were friends before we ever started working on Oh My Gods together. And then kind of, like, somewhere along the way, we came up with this, like, wacky idea, like, what would happen if this girl went to school with gods and goddesses? And, like, it was kind of almost a joke at first, and then all of a sudden we kind of just, like, realized we wanted to write this. And so when we kind of started taking it really seriously and putting it all together, we came up with it all together. And I'm, like, a lot more, like, I like kind of figuring out the plot beats. I like kind of seeing where the story goes. And Inch is, like, very character driven. Mm. And, you know, so in that kind of initial phase, it's like, what about, like, this sort of stuff? Like, you know, like, it's like kind of brainstorming the characters together. But then Insha would make, like, Pinterest boards and mood boards and Spotify playlists and get into. Yeah. So she really, even before Juliana Moon was on board, our artist, you know, was really kind of crafting their personalities and kind of their whole aesthetic behind the scenes. And so we built all that stuff up. We knew the kind of general story we wanted to do. And we spent a kind of good chunk of time either, like, kind of talking on the phone or just talking in, like, Messenger to build the skeleton of the story. So basically we went in and did a really, really, really extensive outline where, you know, every single plot beat is more or less accounted for. And we built that together until we were happy. And from there, I went in and did, like, the script. I'm a pretty fast, like, scripter, especially, like, if I've got this skeleton in place. Like, it's basically just converting the bullet points to pages and panels. So I would go in and do that portion of things. And Insha, because she has such a great knowledge of the characters, would go in, and the dialogue I would write would more or less just be placeholder. And she would be like, Tina would sound like this. And so she would tweak the voices to kind of better fit how she saw them and how she kind of, like, had formed them in her mind. We kind of just, like, went back and forth on that and worked on the script until we were both really happy with it. So we both have, like, our fingerprints all over it. And that was kind of how we built both of the books for Oh My Gods 1 and Oh My Gods 2.
Which should be out now.
Yes. Yeah. it seems so weird. Like, we aren't doing, like, as much because, like, we're still in this pandemic thing, and so it's just, like, it kind of feels like anticlimactic sometimes.
Oh, yeah, like, just, like, book tours or talking to school and stuff.
So it feels very bizarre, but it is out now. Yay.
Can't wait to read it. One more question before we get back to the episode. Sure. So with the artist you work with, do you choose them, or is that something that the publisher or the editor brings together?
That's a great question.
Because I know with comics, it almost seems that they kind of team up on their own, but what I know.
And that is kind of what they want usually. Like, editors in comics don't really want to put those teams together unless it's like Marvel and DC and they have like their roster of talent and that sort of thing. But yeah, like all of our books so far are with book publishers, and we have, I have, I should say, like about a 50-50 one way or the other kind of thing. So for instance, with Oh My Gods, Insha and I kind of thought we were going to pitch it within the comics market. So because of that, we went out and found an artist, Juliana, and I had been hiring for another job entirely on Twitter, and Juliana applied for it. And I was like, okay, like, you're not a fit for the job that I'm looking for now.
But look at this.
Yeah, but I was like, but I really think you would be great for this other thing I have. And then I like showed Insha Juliana's work, and we both just fell in love with her. We sent her like the script, the pitch, and Juliana was just like, you want to hire me? Like, we all just like really clicked, and we knew that we had like that chemistry that we were looking for. So we pitched Oh My Gods as a team that was already fully formed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So basically we had got an interest to from a book publisher, actually. We were sending it out in the comic market. And then a book publisher was like, I can't really like do much with this unless you have an agent. So our agent came on board, Maria Vicente, to help get that going. But with Paranorthern, I pitched that as a writer solo, and we basically just like put that out into the world. And our publisher was the one that like hooked us up with Mari Costa.
Okay.
So they basically were like, we love this, blah, 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 blah. And then they helped kind of like, we had discussions about what we wanted the art to look like. Mm-hmm. And had like a few rounds to kind of find perfect artist for the book. So Mari eventually was brought on board, and yeah, so that was all them. And realistically, like, Oh My Gods, we had a lot of conversations about the art, because like Julian would just keep us in the loop as things kind of went on and would ask us if we had questions about the script. But with like Paranorthern, the editor basically was just the go-to person, and I was only kind of like, you know, if they had questions or anything, like, I was happy to kind of help and, you know, let Mari also put her own spin on each of the characters too. If she wanted to switch things, I told the editor, I'm more than happy for the artist to interpret this how they see fit and, you know, play around with this. I'm not like super married to all of this being like a specific way. I want this to feel like Mari's story too.
Right.
So yeah. And then I have like two other projects which are coming out next year, Pillow Talk, which is a YA, and another book called Rack Pack, which is raccoons.
Oh.
and again, on a similar 50-50 kind of basis, you know, Pillow Talk, I pitched as a solo, writer, and we were teamed up with the incredible Mel Valentine, who's amazing. And then Rack Pack, is Whitney Gardner, and we pitched that as series together. So we're co-creators of that, and we built the story together and all of that, but Whitney's doing the art. So yeah, again, it's kind of just like 50-50. It kind of depends on the project. It depends on, maybe I have something very specific in mind for that book, but usually it's a little bit easier to pitch solo as a writer and have the publisher handle the art side of things.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, because I was wondering with that, like with the YA graphic novel market exploding as it is, like how that would translate between kind of the way comics were done and the way, you know, children's books were done. Because sometimes I've heard like even very well established authors don't get to choose their illustrator on in children's books. That's mostly the editor's job. And I was like,
yes.
Oh my gosh.
I was warned about that kind of like upfront, like Paranorthern. So Oh My Gods came out first, but technically speaking, I actually sold Paranorthern first. Mm-hmm. But like the timing, just publishing is weird. Things take forever. Paranorthern is a longer book as well. But yeah, like I was kind of told by my agent, like, just so you know, if we go this book publisher route, like, you might not have a say in the art. Like, you just be aware of the fact that they might have house artists that they want to work with, and you can't really be precious about that if that's what you would like to do. But my editor was absolutely wonderful and was so inclusive of me throughout the whole process, and made sure that my voice was heard, made sure that, like, the creators that we were, like, courting to kind of bring on board, those were people I was on board with, you know, like, there was nothing kind of behind my back and be like, this is the artist we've got. So
right,
it was a really wonderful experience all around. And editors are so overworked and underappreciated. And I swear to God, I would take a bullet from my editor. Like, she's just the best person, and made Paranorthern, like, which again was my first book, the best possible experience I could have had.
Well, it's a great book.
Even you swear to gods.
Right. Yes, exactly. Ooh. I misspoke.
Ooh, crossover. Well, excellent. Thanks for answering those questions. Shall we get back to the second segment of Microbots?
Transformers.
So we get to Megatron and his lightning fingers. And
good animation, but bad continuity. Where did all these guys show up from?
Yeah, you're right.
They were never even on the mission.
Yeah, there's only like four of them driving to South America, but now we have Cliffjumper and Blue Streak and Ironhide, and they're all getting taken out by Megatron. And even Huffer. I hope I get lucky. Huffer's like the little yellow truck.
And then Iguana.
Yeah. And then we see Smokescreen. Kind of
Where
his
did
first.
You come from?
Yeah. And this is kind of his time to shine. He creates an actual smoke screen around Megatron. And then the Autobots just shoot the mountain and create a rock slide and bury all the Decepticons.
Works
and then,
every time.
Yeah, and then, they take their wounded. They kind of make a point that they're all beat up and we got to get them back to the base. They're going back to South America, from South America to Oregon. Back to their base to repair them.
In 5 minutes.
And then this is kind of the... after I think maybe the second or third time I watch this, I kind of had to think of how their plans to confront the superpowered Megatron, how that stacks up. So they're back at their base, and Perceptor's doing all his science stuff, and Optimus is like, hey, you got to stop this. We need all the power for a force field.
The light's dim.
Right. Optimus's idea is to create a force field to just repel the superpowered Megatron as long as possible. But then Perceptor has an idea that rather than create a force field, how about we shrink three people down, go inside of Megatron, and disconnect the heart of Cybertron?
What?
Sounds like a bad idea until you see the size of the force field.
Yeah, it sounds like a bad idea. But later on in the episode, we find out that the force field only lasts 5 minutes. No. But the force field only is big enough to cover three Autobots.
That's not big.
So I think Perceptor's crazy idea is actually the more sound idea.
It is, though.
It turns out to be more successful. I'm not sure what Prime was thinking with this.
It just feels very Magic School Bus, like, let's, like, shrink down, let's go do this thing. I love it.
Yeah, and he says it so matter-of-factly. What, like, well, we can shrink you down and go inside, and it'll be no problem. He was already shrinking.
Obviously.
Yeah, he was already shrinking circuitry at the beginning of the episode, so you know it's possible.
Exactly. We've established there's been some foreshadowing.
Yes.
Like, yeah, love that.
And the Decepticons crawl out of the rock slide. So the plan is we have, it's Perceptor, Brawn, and Bumblebee, right?
Wow, the two troublemakers and then the guy in between.
Naturally, we have to, like, get this tension sorted out.
Exactly. And so they put him in Power Glide, and then they fly off. They fly off toward the Decepticons, who, Stephanie, you have to admit, this was the highlight of the episode, where the Decepticons are on the eve of battle, and they decide to get drunk.
Yeah, naturally. I mean,
Cybertron.
It's time to party with some nuclear moonshine, and just why not? And I do appreciate that they had them like slurring and like just like fully being committing to the drunk bit.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Hiccuping, mm-hmm. Rumble's hiccuping. We see Laserbeak crash. So how does that? The bird drank some.
Oh, yeah. But he had a little bird bath full of Energon.
The French champagne.
I know. Yeah, he's totally doing like the drunk Orson Welles outtakes. Megatron's just reminiscing about the good old days.
What's better than just a bunch of robots getting absolutely smashed?
I wonder, I'm not sure this would pass in a show today. I mean, even though they're not.
I very much doubt him. There's like a lot of stuff. I think we've established that there's like a lot of traumatizing movies and TV shows from like the 80s and 90s and earlier sure. than that too, that would not be made today. Like even the Neverending Story is low key terrifying. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of things that I think people would be like, we cannot show this to children. And then we say stuff like, we turned out fine, but like, let's all like just take a moment to admit that all of us need therapy. So
that's what happened when you see Transformers the movie.
Oh, gosh. At the end of season two, between season two and season three, they made a movie where they basically killed off all of the hero Autobots, all the Transformers that you knew and loved through two seasons, to replace them with new, we say characters, you say toys. And they just did it in the most brutal way possible. Like within the first 10 minutes of the movie, everyone's just full-blooded murdered.
The first one, the toughest one, gosh. Braun.
Oh yeah, Braun, the jerk. He was
the first one killed. Can't see it, but finger quotes. There's a fan theory that he's and he's not really dead. That's tough.
Wild. Again, I rewatched Sailor Moon for the first time. And you know, like anime and like those 80s kind of cartoons were similar in a lot of ways too. But like I think about the end of the first season of Sailor Moon, and they straight up killed all of the Sailor Scouts and then are just like, they were reincarnated by the next season. And I'm like, this doesn't track. Like, they murdered them.
Yeah.
And you don't really think about that a whole lot. You know, like, they did some, like, really messed up things to these, like, characters. They don't make things like they used to. Which
no.
is maybe a good thing in some cases, but, like.
Right.
Poof.
So we're getting ready for commercial number two as the little guys, the microbots, go inside of Megatron to disconnect the heart.
Who and why is Jeff from Oh My Gods?
I have been talking about this like so much lately because I'm like, you put a character on a book that's like not in the book at all, and everyone will latch on to the character that is like
barely in the book. I don't know why that happens.
I don't know either. And I don't know why we joked that we were like, people are going to love Jeff. And yet I still fully don't think I understood that people would love Jeff. Jeff actually is in the second book a lot, though. So he does. These questions do get answered in the second book. And in fact, in the first book, for anyone who's unfamiliar, this is a character from Oh My Gods. Also, my cat is purring into the microphone. So if you hear like a low key, like, that is my cat who's providing some additional sound effects here. But in the first Oh My Gods, there is a little like throwaway scene where you're meeting everybody in the cafeteria at Mount Olympus Junior High. And there's just Jeff. And Jeff really loves pancakes. Who doesn't?
Super into pancakes.
Super into pancakes. I relate strongly to Jeff. So in the second book, or even on the cover of the book, my favorite detail is if you look at the arcade cover, if you bring up the second book cover, the little like Pac-Man arcade game that's on there, on the cover, the little like, in a Pac-Man game, there's usually like fruit that you have to kind of collect, mm-hmm. and they're like mm-hmm. bonuses. They're all pancakes on the cover for the Forgotten Maze. So it's my favorite low-key little like detail that Juliana just like stuck in there.
Oh, we're pulling it up now. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So they're all little pancakes.
Awesome.
In Paranorthern, when the news reporter is supporting the bunnies.
Yep, yep, yep.
When they said, oh my gods, is that a reference to the book?
Yes. yeah, there's definitely, so, yeah. Again, I'm just like also very into Greek mythology. So that is like just a thing that I feel I would deeply kind of just like bring up randomly all the time. But like in Oh My Gods 2, there's, I think, a Paranorthern poster that Juliana put into Karen's room somewhere. And there's like some definite like crossover things, little kind of Easter eggs, I suppose. So there's definitely hints of both books in the other books. Yeah. I'm like trying to find the poster. I can't remember, but I remember Juliana sending it to us and being like, look, but somewhere in there.
Were any of Karen's online friends from Oh My Gods based on real people, or any characters in any of the books based on real people?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, all of them are definitely fictional characters, but I think like the best way to kind of write relatable characters and kind of really like mostly like believable dialogue is like everybody kind of has their own way of speaking and talking and different kind of like tone and inflection and all those fun things. And basing those on like people that you kind of know and like the way they talk kind of just like helps to make voices a little bit more unique. So it's like you think about how, like, for instance, in Paranorthern, Hannah, who's one of my favorite characters, is this ray of sunshine, and she's just really positive and she's very like bubbly and silly. And one of my very best friends in the world is like, I would again describe her as a ray of sunshine, and I frequently do, as I just did. And yeah, like kind of thinking about when you're writing the dialogue, it's like, how would this friend respond to this? Or how would, you know, they interact in this situation? And so like Hannah is an original character and isn't kind of physically or in a big way based on my friend, but the way she interacts with the other characters does that kind of make sense? It's a weird roundabout way. So they're all original characters. Insha wrote the gamer friends. So again, Insha is a big gamer, a big like movie fan, a big, you know, she loves building those characters. So she was like, Seth, can I do all the video game stuff? And it was like 100%, like have at it. And I'm sure she's definitely based them on the same sort of thing. They're fictional, but I'm sure she has inspirations for them, if that makes sense. But
yeah,
for that portion, you'd like have to ask her specifically.
Maybe we'll have her on the show in the future.
Yeah, she's very fun. And she might actually watch Transformers. I'm not sure. She's a very eclectic person. So. Ah.
Well, let's wrap up this episode of Transformers, of Microbots, where now we're in the journey to the center of Megatron portion.
Again, Magic School Bus.
Yeah. Which I think is really fun. I love the architecture of the inside of Megatron, like how it just makes no sense. It's almost
a year later.
But yeah, like the backgrounds are really crazy, and like his shoulder joint is just a bunch of cogs and gears.
Yeah. Which like doesn't make sense, but it's just like, I guess I understand why they were like, what would the inside look like?
You don't have time to figure that out.
Yeah, we're just gonna make it a machine, which like doesn't make sense if they're like, but you just there's a certain degree of don't ask questions,
right,
that you really have to put into play here.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like it though, because it looks so otherworldly. And even when you get to his brain, they don't make it look like a brain. It's just kind of this kind of glowing thing with
brain
all these
worms.
Oh yeah. And then yeah, the what did they call them? His evil brain impulses, which are these like weird metal snake demons.
They have faces.
Yeah. Yeah, they come out of Megatron's brain, which Braun, he's like, why don't we just start punching his brain? Like, no. Because he's flying. He's flying toward the base. Well, back up. Megatron arrives at the Ark, and he's getting ready to fight them. And they got, yeah, this really cool animation. Yeah, there's like maybe 15 seconds of like high grade anime animation with like Megatron's fingers outstretching and Warpath the tank, like when he fires the missile, has like that kind of anime zoom in and the camera whips around. Yeah, we're watching it right now. That's really cool stuff. It's like, yeah, sometimes they kind of save the really good animation for the third act. And back on the inside, yeah, this is one of my favorite shots where they jump on one of the evil snake demons.
Yep.
Because they figure out if they just hop on one, it'll lead them to the heart of Cybertron. And it does. Naturally. Then Perceptor, this is where he gets his hands dirty, which is what Braun has been ragging him on the entire episode. He starts disconnecting them. The force field breaks and Megatron's about to like deliver the fatal blow. And then he's like, his fingers, like nothing, no lightning coming out of the fingers.
Oh no. And then, no.
Yeah.
This cannot be.
Oh, shouldn't have had that drink last night. Oof. Can you imagine the writer's room for this episode, though? Like, just, I deeply am curious about them pitching this episode and be like, yeah. And then they all get drunk and then they shrink them all down. And like, just somebody be like, yeah, that's the stuff. That's good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were probably cranking these out so quickly. In fact, the writer is David Wise, which we actually did. I did a little profile on him a few episodes ago. He wrote a lot of He-Man episodes and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle episodes. He wrote like 72 episodes. And
Doesn't shock me. Like, yeah, like toy crossover guy. Like, we're going to.
Exactly.
We're going to write to sell toys.
And in my research of him, he was known for kind of recycling plots through the episodes. So like, so there might be an episode of He-Man where like Skeletor gets drunk, or maybe there's a Ninja Turtle episode where Shredder and Krang get drunk. I want to see that episode.
GIF of Skeletor though, of like him drinking, like there's like a very prominent GIF.
Now I gotta research that. You may have hit,
you know what
something.
I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like, yep. I wonder. Okay. I wonder.
I got to look that up to see if he wrote that episode and if it's kind of the same plot.
But, yeah. I'm very
curious. He turns really small and. Okay.
He goes into his bones.
But I'm so sorry. I'm like the queen of derailing everything. And I just.
No, that's totally fine.
I can do that about anything. Like, I'm like, I don't know anything about Transformers yet. I'm going to find a way to derail this entire show.
And you're sending me down the rabbit hole of researching He-Man episodes. I gotta track that Skeletor GIF back down. Let's wrap this up. This is one of my favorite shots where the three Autobots are literally growing on top of Megatron's chest as they're running away, and they don't bother to like, you know, kick him or something. You know, like they could have.
Dismantles his brain.
Yeah, they could have ended the show with this, but we have 40 more episodes.
But they got
to get
more
out.
Things to sell.
Yes. There's more energy devices to steal, more plots to be had. But even like a Bumblebee turns around, he's like, "Oh, excuse me," and Megatron gives up. He takes off. We got a plan for the next episode.
He doesn't want to be hung over and near the Ark.
Yeah, he's got to have a cup of coffee. And so they return the Heart of Cybertron, which then it starts to overload, and they throw it in the air, and then who takes the shot but Perceptor? Braun throws it in the sky, Perceptor blows it up, and now they're best buddies.
Good shot.
Yep. And then he kind of pats him on the chest, like, my new friend, and if anybody has anything to say about it. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, I love the little, hey, Pat.
Yeah.
Brain and Braun are now friends.
There you go. That is the end of Microbots. Stephanie, we usually rate the episodes 1 to 10. 1 to 10 Energon cubes. So as our guest, and we do not refer back to these, you will not be judged upon your answer. And we pretty much forget what we gave the episodes as soon as we give them. But what did you think of Microbots?
Well, for somebody who's watched next to no Transformers, I was entertained, but also confused. We'll say a 7.5 out of 10.
Okay. Emmett, you want to go next? I usually
yes,
go next.
Yes, I do. Give it a daring 8.75.
Ooh,
since
okay.
I do have knowledge of Transformers, I really like this. I really like the South America jokes. Like
nice little moments.
If
like
I
that.
Could refer back to one line, like, we don't want to cause an impression on the jungle. That's not our style. Excuse me. Like, what? They just blasted through an African jungle.
Yeah, the
like,
episode.
A couple episodes ago.
The episode when they went to Africa, they. Two Autobots basically hung on the side of Optimus Prime and just blew a hole right through the jungle.
And yet, like, it's not our style.
Well, maybe they've learned. Elsa, what did you think?
I think, like, an 8.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I liked the jokes. There weren't many errors. I liked the storyline. I liked that Perceptor was in it. And... that's pretty much all.
Okay. I think I'll go 8.5. Again, I always like episodes that kind of break the mold a bit.
Yes.
It's not kind of the typical Transformers episode. And again, the plot structure had me guessing. Like, what are we dealing with? Is it a mystery spacecraft episode? Is it a superpowered enemy? Or now it's a... you know, get really small and go inside the bad guy.
We watched this during the pandemic, I remember.
Yeah. When you were home from school, yeah, we were watching these, which kind of inspired the show.
Yeah.
I do like that it gave us something different and gave us Perceptor, which is one of the new characters we haven't seen a lot from, even though it's your favorite character, Emma.
Getting
we
a
haven't
studio
really seen
series
him a lot.
Soon.
Yes. The toy should be arriving in the mail pretty soon. But yeah, I thought it kind of utilized the characters pretty well. Optimus's force field idea was really awful. Okay, so yeah, that wraps up Microbots. So Stephanie Cook, I want to thank you very much for venturing into the land of the Transformers, watching the episode, and going through Microbots with us. It was fun to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for bringing Transformers back into my life. And it was a lot of fun.
Is there anything else you want to plug before we go? We've covered your books a lot, but if there's anything else you want to talk about?
No, I mean, I'm terminally online. If you have questions, if you want to say hello,
mm-hmm.
I'm at HelloCookie on Twitter and Instagram, StephanieCook.ca. That has all the information. That has all the things you could possibly want to know. And yeah.
And Oh My Gods 2, The Forgotten mm-hmm. Maze is out, correct?
Yes. And you can go to ohmygods.org to learn more about it.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. And not sure what the next episode is. Let's look here.
Episode 12.
Yes, this will be the Master Builders.
I'm just
that episode. I think I know what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we hope that you enjoy listening to this, and you'll be back next week on one more Prime. Bye.
Bye, everybody.